In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Back in 1980, when Reagan was running against Carter, he famously asked, "Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?" Pretty much anyone alive at that time would have to say no. No, they weren't. That same question can be asked today with the same answer. We have American veterans living on the streets. Families all across America who are making the median income can't afford to buy median-priced homes, unless they have a huge down payment, and who in this economy has been able to save up a ton of money. It's getting so average families can't even afford to go out for dinner, and too many restaurants are going out of business, unable to afford to stay in business. Meanwhile, Biden and the Democrats are putting up millions of illegal immigrants in five-star hotels and giving them free food and cash. What you're going to hear today, and hopefully loud and clear, is how incredibly important it is to elect quality leaders, and not what we have now, which is too many figureheads being controlled by the bureaucracies and agencies that they are supposed to oversee. That is completely backward from the vision of our forefathers. That was not how America was designed, but it is how America will fail. What we need in office are people of high moral character who remember that the responsibility of government is to ensure our freedoms, not to constantly set boundaries against them, or to undermine them, or to whittle them away until they effectively don't exist, existing only in the theoretical realm rather than in practice. We have a split show today with two guests, but which tie together quite nicely. In the first half, we'll hear from one of those candidates looking to be elected to the Secretary of State's office, which definitely requires someone of high moral character, because we've seen what happens when we don't have someone like that in office. This is an office that oversees other agencies, so you absolutely better have someone in there who will hold other agencies to high standards and to keep them following the law. And then our second guest will give you the perfect example of what happens when someone like the president ignores laws, including giving foreign workers more rights than American workers. Stay tuned for that. Sometimes there just isn't enough time to deal with everything, and that was the case last week with Republican candidate for Secretary of State, Dennis Lithcomb. So this is part two as we dig into the Secretary of State office, what it does and what it ought to be doing. Dennis, it's good to talk to you again. Welcome back.
You bet. It's good to be here. You know, when we finished last week, I thought, boy, we could have kept going.
Yes.
And so I'm glad to come back on, and we can probably keep going after today's interview as well. But
yes,
we'll do the best we can.
That's right. Well, we'll just have to have you back again some other time. So, you know, just to quickly review, the Secretary of State is Oregon's chief election officer, chief auditor, and oversees the state archives and the Oregon Corporation Division. The Secretary of State also serves as one of three members of the state land board and is also the chair of the Oregon Sustainability Board. So I'd like to kind of really just dive right back into where we had left off, the power of auditing, because in asking about audits, I still have more questions about the Secretary of State's audit power. And from our discussion last week, it kind of sounded like the audit power of the Secretary of State is different than what we would normally think of in terms of audit power. Like, for example, the IRS. The IRS finds something amiss with your books, especially if you didn't pay enough taxes. They can levy fines and even put you in jail. With the Secretary of State, it's more about how well and how appropriately the money was allocated. The money that was allocated was spent, but if something is misspent, the Secretary of State can only effectively point it out rather than actually hold somebody accountable. So correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you've got the power of audit, but not the power of accountability. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, that's probably a fair way. The other side of the investigatory arm or audit arm of the Secretary of State is to ensure compliance with regulations. When you think of IRS audits, you're thinking, do the debits and credits add up correctly? Does the percentage of tax payment match the revenue and income statement, et cetera? And it's not dealing with that so much as compliance with regulations, optimizing resource allocation, and providing a standard for accountability and effective governance. And that's why it's become so important. For example, I think we ought to be examining Oregon Health Authority, Education, Environmental Quality, Water Resource Department, Transportation Department, the Justice Department, all of those departments impact so many millions of Oregonians that we need to know, are they really doing, do they have the authority they claim to have when they're knocking at your front door or when they're beating your front door down with a battering ram? And I think it's appropriate to review and understand the governance model, the accountability model, what they're actually trying to accomplish. Water Resources is trying to shut off water in Eastern Oregon. Is that valid? Is it invalid? Is it true? Is it false? Why are they pursuing this? You know, and those are questions that everybody will have. ODOT has been misspending money. We know they've misallocated economic resources for the past 5 years. ODOT right now, the Transportation Committee at the Senate level is expecting a 95 cent per gallon increase in gas tax. Jeez. In the state of Oregon. 95 cents a gallon.
That's an increase or total?
Increase. Whoa.
Jeepers.
And that increase is because they have not been allocating resources appropriately between heavyweight vehicles and lightweight vehicles and electronic vehicles, the heaviest of all, those electric, you know, BEVs, battery electric vehicles, don't pay any gas tax. And so there's a misalignment between what they've been collecting and what they need, and they've got a $1.6 billion FUPA in how they've been cutting out corners on all your sidewalks and putting in those little, you know, ADA accessible right. down ramps, and they installed thousands of those incorrectly and are mm-hmm. There's a lawsuit, $1.6 billion to correct the mismanagement of that. This is going to all result in a gas tax minimum 95 cents. They wow. did not, the Democrat majority did not do it during the short session because they know they're about to get cleaned in the November election, and they wanted to put that on somebody else's shoulders, i.e. the next legislative body. But as long as our legislators continue to play the role of coward in tow, they will never deal with the problem in front of them. We see it at the federal level, yep. too. Nobody is dealing with the trillions of dollars, yeah. trillion dollars in debt.
When there's just no end of funds coming in and being spent, it's almost hard to keep track of. And, you know, you just keep right on spending rather than asking yourself whether or not you should be spending that. And that's really the big problem. Okay, it is time for a break. Come back. We'll have more with Dennis Lithicum. He is running for the Secretary of State here in Oregon. Coming up, we're going to be talking about if some money has been misspent, what then? Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Senator Dennis Lithicum. He's a soon-to-be former state senator, I should say, but he is the Republican candidate running for the Oregon Secretary of State. And he was our guest last week as well, but we had so much more to talk about that we wanted to have him back on. And we probably still won't get through everything as we said in that last segment there. So, Dennis, as I said going out of that break there, so you do an audit as the Secretary of State, and you find that money is not being spent appropriately or misspent or any number of issues. So if you find that out, what then? I mean, do you turn it over to, and especially if it's like really egregious misspending, what are the next steps after you find that money is not being spent appropriately?
Well, I think the main part of it is it's a bully pulpit issue. And there's a three-prong Republican answer to accountability in the state of Oregon. We have Will Lathrop running for attorney general, mm-hmm. and we have Brian Boquist running for state treasurer, and you have myself running for secretary of state. These are the three key executive positions that actually organize, engineer, and focus on holding government accountable. The AG is, kind of on the criminal side, treasurer making sure the numbers are accurate and the claims that we're making can be validated and are truthful, and then the Secretary of State's position being the actual auditor who's got the spreadsheet and adding up the numbers and cross-checking them and footing the columns and making sure this is a valid statement. And then this is a perfect opportunity for citizen involvement and bully pulpit, smashing the clay jars that have been stacked around the state of Oregon for decades.
Well, that would be awesome to see the Republicans sweep in all three of those offices. Clearly, things are not working the way that they are. And to keep handing them back to the same party that has had these for so long, it's just, it's like the definition of insanity. You don't keep electing the same type of people and then expect different results.
Well, I think the key point to this is in terms of summarizing, effective governance and accountability, there has to be some methodology for weighing alternatives. In economics, this is known as opportunity cost. If you spend $2 on that burger over there, you don't have the opportunity to go buy those two tacos across the street. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. That's a choice. It's an opportunity loss, though. You don't get to enjoy tacos. Now, when it comes to state, you cannot just mandate that all of a sudden with these unique circumstances and shifting resources and legislative requirements, I'm going to spend my money on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusiveness, and I'm not going to patch the potholes out front on Main Street. At some point, there's a trade-off. Every dollar I spend on DEI is a dollar that does not get spent appropriately on water management, on street and highway management, on justice and, criminal prison systems or whatever those might be. All of those things are all part of the trade-off game, and the public should be well aware of these trade-offs because politicians like to make it sound like they can provide everything every day, all the time for everyone. And it's just not a possibility.
Well, and it's crazy because now we're also going to see that with a ballot initiative that's likely to qualify. It's the start of universal basic income where they want to tax corporations, sales over $25 million worth. They want to put 3% on that, and then they're going to redistribute that wealth to everybody. And we just can't keep taxing everything out there. We can't provide everything for everybody, and it's time that people start learning that.
Yeah, well, and this IP17 that you're referring to is really, really a dangerous concept.
Yes.
I believe you're right. It's sales. So you don't have to have a profit of $25 million. You just have to, your profit could be $2.
Yep.
But if you, to get that $2 in profit, you had to generate $25 million in sales. Boink, you're going to get this gigantic tax. And then the return on that money goes back to every citizen living in the state of Oregon for 200 days. That means every six-month-old, every two-year-old, every five-year-old, every 10-year-old, every 18-year-old, every 93-year-old, everybody gets $750 in the mail. I want to see how they're going to address, checks to six-month-old kids, and what bank accounts are they going to automatically create to deposit that money. And then what's the legislature going to do next year? Raise it from 750 or lower it to 250 and raise lower the taxing ceiling from 25 million down to 15 million. These are things the public gets snowed, they get schnookered, they get, you know, the corrupt.
Well, you can do that kind of thing. You can snooker people when they don't have the educational basis to understand anything different. If they don't have a grounding in basic economics, in fact, even you can even graduate now in Oregon without a basic understanding of math. And so it's easy to snicker people. The less educated people are, the easier it is to fool them. And unfortunately, we're seeing that here in Oregon. Okay, everyone, stay with us. We'll have more with Senator Dennis Lithcomb. He is running for Oregon Secretary of State. His website, if you'd like to go visit that and find out more about him, is electdennis.com. That's electdennis.com. Coming up, we'll be talking about Dennis's opposition to Tobias Reid. And welcome back. We're talking about the Secretary of State office today, and we're doing that with Senator Dennis Lithcomb. He is a Republican candidate running for that office. And Dennis, before we get into your opposition there, as far as the powers that the Secretary of State has, are there oversights or other responsibilities that the Secretary of State ought to have but they don't?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I haven't thought a lot about things that the Secretary of State also ought to do. For example, I know what they shouldn't do, but I'm not sure I have a wish list for what the office ought to do. Right now, delivering services, adhering to statutory guidelines, the legislature pumps 4,000 bills into committees every long session. So that's what's going to face us coming up. There's no limit to the number of bills that a legislator can bring, senator or representative. And there are so many of these, and they are saddled with so many statutory guidelines and whatever that I think, quite frankly, nobody pays attention to. They're in there for political momentum. They're in there to get people to feel comfortable voting yes when they should vote no. And they are swallowing the productivity of every individual within the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
And you know, unfortunately, all of these rules and regulations, they don't come with instructions telling us how to do what it is we're chartered with doing. And both sides can haggle over the facts and use the information for their own, you know, arsenals left or right. And yet at some point, all of those different arenas are just saddled with philosophical assumptions and prior commitments, a priori commitments. And so to get to the bottom of some of these things will be really difficult as Secretary of State. But I think this is what my competition actually cannot do. They cannot provide that kind of distance worldview. They're not skeptical enough of the system. They believe in the system. And quite frankly, I think that's a false belief. It's a false god. And we should be far more skeptical of the services that government provides.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, what you just said kind of, again, gets back to opportunity cost, except instead of hard money, it's an opportunity cost in terms of time. The time that you spend on dealing with regulations and all the rest is time not spent on producing money or profits, for that matter. Just to dig a little bit more into Tobias Reid, I mean, he is the current state treasurer. So can you expand on that? Why would Tobias Reid not be a good fit for the office, and why would he not do as good a job as you would?
Well, look at his history. Even look at his advertising campaigns that he ran during the primary. He wasn't talking about performing the duties as outlined for the Secretary of State. He wasn't talking about audits. He was talking about DEI. He was talking about making sure the Secretary of State's office is diverse and inclusive and everybody gets treated with equality. And those are all fine notions, but that's not your job. That's not your responsibility. That's a bully responsibility, if anything. And what he should have been saying is, I've been a treasurer for 8 years and I know how to add a column of numbers, but he didn't even tell us that. Mm-hmm. And so I think the problem that he faces is he's been part of this team. He's been he has never been in the private enterprise environment. He's never run a business. He's never suffered an audit from the IRS, as you mentioned earlier. There is no level of outside authority or accountability. He's been in the legislator role where he's writing the laws. And now he's part of the big blue team and he bows to the whims of the governor and is more than happy to do that. And I think it's one of those positions where you actually wouldn't ask, somebody who's been involved in, an illicit affair to investigate other members that you think have been involved in illicit affairs. It's just not how the game's played. You need someone from the outside to have a fair eye.
Sure. Well, Tobias Reid being the current treasurer, I guess when it comes to advertising, people hear the word treasurer and they just assume that he's got his background in, auditing and accounting and all the rest. Does he have any accomplishments as treasurer that he can point to that he can brag about?
I don't think so, but again, I've got a pony in this race. I don't know that I actually don't. I haven't paid attention to his background in terms of specifics because I know it's been part of the government enterprise. Hmm. And so his background, his ingenuity, his innovation, his skill set for solving problems isn't obvious because no problems ever get solved by government. They create problems. Yes. They don't solve problems. Yeah. And so I don't know the answer specifically if he has things that he's touting, but his commercials don't lead me to believe he's got any accomplishments. It's all political blather.
Hmm. Well, you'd mentioned that in those ads, he didn't really talk about the responsibilities of the job. So what is he unlikely to do that you would do?
The most unlikely thing is, perform, arm's length audits that actually are relevant. For example, Shamia Fagan was involved in the Secretary of State's office, was disgracefully,
forced to resign, yeah.
Forced to resign, yeah. I guess that's the best terminology. She was forced to resign. And why? Because, quote unquote, she had an outside contract with the individual she was licensing.
Right.
Now, that ought to be as obvious to anybody on the street that this is inappropriate and should no government agency, official, or bureaucrat should ever engage in this kind of behavior. But she didn't see a problem with it. And so I think Tobias is going to end up in that same deep blue sea where he does not see problems that are obvious to everybody else on the street. Mm. And so I come with almost as a professional skeptic. I come into this marketplace. I understand what it means to establish robust privacy management and how to mitigate risks in the private sector and to think analytically and to strengthen the various aspects of what the office should be doing, how they should be doing it, how to get and keep people involved, because public visibility and transparency yep. is one of the key notions here.
Yes.
Why, for example, were we banned?
I was just going to say, we are up against the clock here, and you mentioned Shamia Fagan, and if you can't see the ethical issues where you're taking a side gig with somebody that you're supposed to be overseeing, that's just ridiculous, and we do not need another Shamia Fagan, and I do think that Tobias Reid may end up being that. Dennis, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. Bring me back for part three. I was just getting started.
There you go. Southeastern Legal Foundation fights to defend your constitutional rights when government decides to trample them, which seems to be happening more and more these days, and that stems from people in government thinking they have ultimate power and you peons out there have none, and certainly no right to complain. And there's a new case that Southeastern Legal is involved in where Joe Biden suddenly decided to throw out about 100 years worth of precedent and give the right to unionize to illegal immigrants. And to talk about that and more, I'd like to welcome Kimberly Herman back to the show. She is the chief. She is the general counsel for Southeastern Legal. Kim, it's great to talk to you again.
Great to be here with you.
Yeah. So, you know, just to warm up a little, we're going to throw you off the high dive into the deep end where there's sharks swimming around. And we want you to solve some First Amendment legal doctrines. So coincidentally, and very conveniently, I might add, just in time for our show, the state of Louisiana just enacted a law mandating that the Ten Commandments be displayed in classrooms, prominently displayed at all public schools and colleges, and that law was immediately challenged, as you can imagine, by the ACLU and among others. And they said the law violates the separation of church and state and is blatantly unconstitutional, but recent decisions on the Supreme Court may be throwing a wrench into the ACLU's lawsuit there. But, you know, so before we dive into the deep end there with you, I know this isn't your case, but Southeastern Legal does handle free speech cases. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, is it blatantly unconstitutional?
I mean, honestly, this case is a little bit in the gray area of the law right now. And if anything, when we see the Louisiana state legislature going ahead and saying, put the Ten Commandments in the classroom, you kind of have to look at what the other side is doing, right? We're seeing in classrooms LGBTQIA+ flags.
Right.
We're seeing BLM flags. We are seeing situations where kids have to take and make anti-racist pledges. And to be perfectly honest, a lot of people see that as a religion.
Yes.
And so, you know, I kind of have to wonder, is the Louisiana state legislature making a point here, right? And that there is ability to have prayer in classroom. There is ability to have religion in our public schools, right? In the long history of our country, even though, you know, we have this establishment clause, which a lot of people say means no religion in government spaces, it actually allows for the accommodation of religion.
Hmm.
But what does that mean and how far? And so if the ACLU wants to sue against this, well, then it opens the door for groups like ours to come in and say, get that BLM pledge out of the class, get that LGBTQIA+, you know, flag out of the class, because that's a religion in and of itself,
sure,
as many of us would believe.
Sure. Well, you can even say that science has become a religion, because if you don't believe the accepted doctrine, then you're a heretic. I think that does open the door. You know, a lot of what you're saying kind of echoes some statements from 2022 that Neil Gorsuch and Justice Roberts were saying at the time. And they had, in fact, Gorsuch, I think was a part of an opinion. He said that the lower courts had created a vice between the Establishment Clause. And just as a reminder, that's the part in the First Amendment which states Congress cannot establish a state religion. He said that it's a vice between the Establishment Clause on one side and free speech and free exercise clauses on the other. And instead, he viewed the Establishment and free exercise clauses as complementary and working together to decrease unnecessary government interference with religion. So let me ask it this way. What was the intent of the First Amendment? Was it to keep government out of religion or religion out of government?
It absolutely was not to keep religion out of government, right? And we'll even see this in Congress, right? Congress opens up its sessions with a prayer. And there was a famous case back in 2013, 2014 called Town of Greece. And it's a town in New York. And they were opening up their sessions with prayer. And so the Supreme Court, you know, hit this issue head on. And they made very, very clear that the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment does not require, again, that you keep religion out of classrooms. It does not require that you keep religion out of government. There's a difference between having 10 commandments up on the wall and requiring students to recite it.
Hmm.
It is very clear. The law is very clear. You cannot require students to recite it. You can't even require them to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. That would be considered compelled speech. And it is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has been very clear on this. It's the same reason why we bring lawsuits saying, again, that you can't require kids to make or teachers to make anti-racist pledges. But it doesn't mean that you have to rid the government completely of religion. In fact, I mean, our country was founded on this idea of liberty, right? Mm-hmm. On this idea of natural rights. And so to remove God and all religion from all of our institutions is actually counter to what our founders believed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, here's a thought. If we remove all semblance of God or religion from the public, especially public schools, aren't we in effect legally sanctioning the atheist worldview? I mean, why does their worldview, the lack of God, become the only allowable viewpoint?
I mean, we absolutely are, but it's honestly, this is so pervasive in our government right now and so pervasive in just what's happening in our country that all of our laws and all of our constitutional provisions are being turned on their head. Whether we're talking about, prayer or having a Ten Commandments up, or whether we're even talking about, you know, Title IX, which I know we might get into later. You've had Sarah Parshall Perry from the Heritage Foundation on talking about that, where we're really just bending to a very, very, very small percentage of people in this country, but we're also violating our Constitution to do that. It is wrong and it has to stop, and we will not stop filing lawsuits until it is stopped.
Oh, that's awesome. All right, coming up, Biden once again reached into his dictator hat and pulled out a new power, unilaterally decided to give illegal immigrants more rights than citizens. We'll talk about that case next with Kimberly Herman, General Counsel of Southeastern Legal. Southeastern Legal Foundation fights to defend your constitutional rights when the government decides to run right over them. Their website is slfliberty.com. That's slfliberty.com. And we're talking with Kimberly Herman, their general counsel. And, you know, so as I mentioned going out of that last break there, I'm old enough to remember when the Democrats accused Trump of being a dictator. And now Biden has unilaterally decided to give illegal immigrants more rights than citizens. And just reading from your press release here about this case, Southeastern Legal Foundation is representing Miles Berry Farm and Georgia Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association in a new lawsuit challenging the United States Department of Labor's requirement that will force agricultural employers to allow temporary foreign farm workers to unionize, an unlawful and unprecedented move that will impose significant costs on employers while giving more rights to foreign farm workers than American farm workers. I mean, this seems a rather odd move. Why did he do this, and does he even have the authority to do this?
I don't know why he did it, but he certainly does not have the authority to do it. Back during the New Deal, we saw Congress giving some employees the rights to form labor unions, right? They did this through an act called the National Labor Relations Act, and that was Congress doing that. Interestingly, in the NLRA, the law that I was just talking about, Congress explicitly excluded farm workers. So for 90 years, our farm workers have not had the right to unionize. Now, we can debate that, you know, all day long, but whether or not you agree with that or not is irrelevant here. They were specifically excluded by Congress. Well, now we have the Department of Labor, an executive branch agency, so an extension of Biden, coming in and giving H-2A visa workers, so foreign workers who come here for seasons, right? So really your seasonal workers, and they're getting the right to unionize. They do not have the constitutional authority to be giving these rights to these foreign workers to begin with, let alone the just unbelievable costs that this is and burden that it's going to put on our agricultural industry.
So, just to go back to the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, do you have any idea why they didn't let farm workers unionize?
You know, I am not 100% sure, right? When we go back to legislative records from NLRA from all those years ago, we don't quite, unfortunately, have the internet trail that we have today.
Yeah.
But it was very intentional. And there have been many times over the years that the NLRA has been revisited. There have been, amendments made. And time after time after time again, they have been intentionally excluded from the right to form labor unions. And, you know, it's important for everyone listening to understand, you know, and remember how our separation of powers works. Congress is the branch that has the right to pass laws. An executive agency cannot come in and rewrite those laws. They are not elected officials. They are just bureaucrats put into place by the administration. And they have no constitutional authority to do this. And it is a major question, right? So in other words, it is a major part of the NLRA as to whether or not who gets these rights. So there's multiple levels here where there's this blatant constitutional violation.
Well, you know, just kind of speculating while you're talking there, I wonder if one of the reasons why they did it is meaning they did not give them the right to unionize, is because you would effectively be giving foreigners a lot of control over a vital food source. I mean, imagine what would happen if they suddenly decided to go on strike right at harvest time.
Well, yeah, and we're seeing this outside of even this particular industry, right? I was talking to somebody the other day about the meat industry. And I'm certainly no expert in it, but what they were educating me on the fact that, you know, China and, you know, foreign entities own a significant portion of our meat production. Yes. In this company. And there are a lot of laws and a lot of regulations that are being proposed right now. I should say regulations by these executive agencies that would cede even more power to them. That's really dangerous. And as you mentioned, it's something that all Americans need to think of, especially with the rising costs of food.
Sure, absolutely. So in your press release, you guys state that once again, President Biden is mobilizing the bureaucracy to dismiss and override Congress. I mean, if he's enabled to enact this rule without Congress's input, what happens to any other legislation? I mean, is he thinking this opens the door for him to change laws that Congress has already approved?
I mean, the Biden administration has made it clear, just like the Obama administration did, that they don't care about separation of powers. All they care is the end goal. They don't care what they have to do to get there. Time and time again, they might try to do something through congressional act and they can't get any traction for it. We are now at the end of what will hopefully be the only Biden administration that this country ever sees. And the number of regulations that we have seen come down in the last 2 months is quite frankly unfathomable. It's more than anyone can keep up with. And that's why in the last month, we filed 5 new lawsuits just to battle these egregious actions by the Biden administration.
So what's the status of this? I mean, has it already gone into effect or is it just a proposed change at this point?
It goes into effect later this summer, but it is a formal final regulation, and that's why we filed a lawsuit. We are asking the court to enjoin this from ever going into effect. So we've asked for what's called a preliminary injunction, and the court will be hearing that very soon, I believe in the beginning of July. And so we are hopeful that by mid-July, we will have stopped this rule in its tracks and that the court will say, no, Department of Labor, you may not enforce this. We're going to litigate the case to the end. But as we do that, you cannot move forward with this unconstitutional law or unconstitutional regulation.
So when they put this in place, did they cite anything as to where they thought they had the power to do this?
They're claiming that they get the power from immigration laws, but immigration laws certainly do not give the Department of Labor the authority to give union rights to foreign workers when Congress has explicitly stated that they are not going to give these to agricultural workers. And so they are claiming that's where they get the power from. But when you trace the law, and, you know, I don't want to get into legalese here, but it's a bunch of baloney, to be perfectly honest.
I'm pretty sure that is the legal term for this. But and if not, it ought to be. So. Well, yeah. You know, when you hand them the union card, I guess you can just hand them a voter card, too. So that's probably the next step here. All right.
You got it.
Yep. Okay. A big related SCOTUS case is coming up here pretty soon. The Chevron case, we'll talk about that next with Kimberly Herman. She is the chief counsel for Southeastern Legal. Stay with us. Back in our final segment now with Kimberly Herman. She is the chief counsel. Scratch that. She is the executive director for Southeastern Legal Foundation. Congrats on that. Big promotion there. Southeastern Legal is a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending liberty and will sue the government for its overreaches when it violates constitutional rights. And so, Kim, I'd like to bring up the Chevron doctrine. This is a longstanding doctrine. It gives the executive branch an incredible amount of administrative power over laws that have been passed by Congress. It effectively allows the executive branch to have wide discretion over the implementation of development rules of development of rules, including allowing for administrative law judges to effectively rule on their own oversight of these laws. And you know, I really think that this doctrine is begging to be thrown out, being a holdover of the big government era. And if I remember right, it goes back to the 1920s. The dynamics of all of this is that government passes a law and then washes its hands over the administration of that law, handing over all power to the executive branch. And then we end up with things like what we just discussed, where the Biden administration says, oh, yeah, we'll totally unionize these foreign workers.
That's pretty much what it is, right? So we have these kind of judge-made doctrines where the agencies can come in and they can either interpret their own regulations or they can interpret laws that have been passed by Congress. And then the court says, well, who are we to question that, right? They work with this. They work with this law every day. They must know what it means. And we finally now have a Supreme Court that's saying, wait a minute. That's what we're supposed to do. Under the Constitution, we, the judicial branch, are the ones who interpret the laws, not some, you know, bureaucrat who's not even elected. And so that's what's facing the Supreme Court now. And I think we're finally at a point where the Supreme Court has said enough is enough.
Well, I would certainly hope so. I know that they're expected to rule on this any day now. And a lot of people are thinking that they may throw this out. If this case gets thrown out, does that mean all of those administrative law judges also get thrown out?
It does not, but I would love to see the cases challenging the ALJ's administrative law judges now come up through the courts. What it will mean is that the ALJs have to actually look at how federal courts have interpreted the laws, and they won't be able to just give their own interpretations. And so they're going to kind of have to be in lockstep with what our federal courts say.
Well, that would be pretty awesome to see that. We certainly see that out here in Oregon quite a bit when it comes to environmental issues. We've had administrative law judges just rule by fiat, effectively, over things like water rights and stuff, and very much out of step with federal laws. So do you have any speculation yourself as to which way the court will rule on this?
I think the court's ready. I think the court is ready to overturn Chevron. There have been several cases that have come up in the last several years where they've indicated that, and where, you know, if you read between the lines, it almost does kill the doctrine of Chevron and this agency deference, but the lower courts still continue to apply it. And so it's one of those situations that the court is going to have to come in and very explicitly say Chevron was wrong. It violates the Constitution, it violates separation of powers, it violates due process, and they're going to have to say, lower courts, stop applying agency deference like you have been doing. I'm hopeful that we have a court now that is going to do that, because they've seen that they really have to kind of drop the hammer sometimes. So the federal courts, because we do still have a lot of Obama judges, we have new Biden judges, we have Clinton judges, and they need to be told, stop doing this.
Well, absolutely. You know, I guess when I have looked at this in the past, I have to wonder why it was ever allowed to begin with. Because to me, it really ushered in the era of Congress that just wanted to spend more time at cocktail parties than do their job. We'll just let the administration figure things out about these bills that we didn't read anyway. So why did they think this was a good idea originally?
I mean, honestly, to answer that question, we have to go all the way back to the New Deal, right? I mean, why did they think that creating an administrative state was a good idea to begin with? It was this idea that people that are in the field know, like an expert field. So if you're talking like we were about the Department of Labor, well, they know better than we do. But that is not how America is supposed to work, right? We elect officials to make our laws. And we have federal judges who interpret them and an executive branch who enforces them. It was very clear. And so, you know, I can tell you, we at Southeastern Legal Foundation, we have just not made peace with the New Deal and the administrative state. And that's why we've been bringing case after case after case dealing with these issues. Because at some point, America has to say enough is enough. We have to go back to first principles.
So let's say for a moment that the Chevron doctrine is thrown out. What changes that at that point, and just how big and potentially far-reaching is this going to be?
I mean, it will be a gut punch to the administrative state and to our federal agencies. It will now require that we actually follow the process, again, that was set out by the Constitution. Congress at some point has to get back to doing their job. They have to stop arguing about petty things, and they need to actually look and deal with the real law and the real situations that are facing this country. You know, whether we're talking about our border crisis, whether we're talking about the crisis that we have in our schools right now across the country, there are a lot of things that we could talk about. They need to get back to fixing those things, because that's what the American public cares about. They care about the fact that they can't put food on their table right now. And they don't want these unelected, you know, politicals to be making the laws.
So real quick, what happens to all of those established agency rules that have been put out there under the Chevron doctrine? They suddenly get suspended? What happens?
Well, I mean, the Chevron doctrine is really about how they're interpreting and enforcing these rules. And so it doesn't have an effect on the creation of the rules. But what it does is it will affect how the agencies can enforce them against people and interpret them. They're going to have to go back, and it's not just the rules, right? We've got agencies interpreting federal law, and that's really what we're talking about in Chevron deference. And so it means that they have to look at what Congress intended, go back to congressional intent, go back to the language. Go back to the words in the law.
Yeah.
You can't change what the words mean, right? It's like right now we see the Department of Education changing the definition of sex. It no longer means a boy or a girl. It can literally mean whatever people want.
Yep.
It will stop them from being able to do that.
Well, that would be awesome. I would love to see that apply to all of these agencies that have just had so much overreach. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Kimberly Herman, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
One more time, our guest's websites are electdennis.com, that's electdennis.com, and Kimberly's organization is Southeastern Legal Foundation, and they can be found at slfliberty.org, slfliberty.org. And be sure to visit our website, ispyradio.com, and you can find links to both of those in case you missed it. The Chevron deference, or Chevron doctrine, it goes by both, will have huge implications if the Supreme Court throws that out. And in doing so, will return a lot of the power to where it belongs, the legislature, not the executive branch, and certainly not this executive branch, which seems to think it doesn't need the legislative branch or the judicial. And that means congressmen and senators will need that much more scrutiny. In other words, hold them accountable. Because as we say every week, the best information is you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.